in a world of EMS podcasters. EMS Office Hours is the only live podcast bringing you the latest topics and opinions in EMS. Turn down your scanner and turn up your speakers as we join Jim Hoffman and Josh Knapp on their latest EMS podcasting journey.
Welcome to EMS Office Hours. This is Jim Hoffman.
And this is Josh Knapp.
Hey, Josh, how we doing?
We're doing good, man. We're doing good.
All right. All right. I am trying to get Dave on with us. I think we can bring him in here real quick. I've had a little Skype issue. Dave, are you with us?
You bet.
All righty. All right. Just want to remind anybody listening, I want you to give us a call if you have a comment, concern, question, or topic you want us to maybe cover on the show. It's toll-free. You can call us at 877-217-3924. And, of course, we're on Twitter as well at EMSSafe over on Twitter. And we encourage you, of course, to join our Facebook page. And it's facebook.com/EMS Office Hours.
And if you're a little heads up, if you're not a member of Google Plus, you may know.
Yeah, we're on Google Plus too.
Right.
Well, but this is true.
We are discussing right now a new format.
Yeah.
Maybe going there.
Maybe.
So if you're not on Google Plus, you're just going to be left out of the fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking into that, you know. A lot of technical behind-the-scenes stuff. I have to make sure that will work out for us. But I think if we move to that thing like we discussed, Josh, I think it'll be more interactive for the listeners of the show. So.
Oh, no. It should be, you know, if we can do everything that, that you're looking into that looks like we can do, it should be great. It'll be a real big, good change.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. We'll see how that progresses over the next few weeks or so. Dave, how are you doing? Anything exciting?
No, I'm well. Nothing exciting. It's good to be here.
Dave, do you have any new classes coming out? I know you just finished a class, right?
Yeah, we just finished a class in Brookhaven. We got another class coming up just outside of Detroit in the Garden City Hospital.
I didn't know you went out of state and taught this.
Apparently I do.
Josh, they have, you know, people have heart attacks in every state, you know. It's not just New York.
I thought it was only in the New York area.
No, that's a different course, though, the New York heart attack.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's a STENI. It's a STENI with the NY at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, New York has to be individualized for everything they do. So, you know.
So when are you looking at the classes in Detroit, Dave? Was it a ways down the road or?
No, it's in April. I think we're April 11th, 12th, 13th, that weekend.
All right. Well, send me the info so I can update the webpage.
Sure.
This way people go visit the site at emsseo.com can see the details on that and find out how to sign up, you know, because we have listeners from all over the place.
Yep, you guys are good to me. Promises to be a good 12-week class.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, it's funny.
Hey,
I did a,
you know, on a side thing, Dave, what do you think of Dubin's book?
Dr. Dubin's book? Dale Dubin?
Yeah.
I think the book has provided me with a wealth of information. What I don't like about his book, and it's really not a fault, he probably just never intended it to be a book where you would go on, read it, and completely get everything. His book tells you what the information is for 12-lead, whether it's atrial enlargement or hypertrophy or an infarction. And he gives you one example. And when you're learning something like this, you need to see hundreds of good examples and things that are close but not quite right. We call it instance, non-instance. Mm-hmm. If you want to get good at, you need to look at hundreds of them, if not thousands of them, those 12 leads. And I wish he had more of that.
Wouldn't you say, too, Dave, that when you talk about looking at hundreds of EKGs, I was one thing that I go by too, and it's not just with EKGs. Like everything you do, like blood pressures or anything, that you should be doing hundreds of normal EKGs.
Absolutely.
Hundreds of normal blood pressures. Hundreds of normal, you know, assessments, so that when you see the abnormal, it stands out to you more.
You know, I just had this conversation with one of my colleagues today. We were talking about instruction. He's new as an instructor. And I told him that when I teach patient assessment to the EMT class, and patient assessment is one of those, it starts with a lecture before you've ever had anything medical or traumatic. And you've already learned, quote, patient assessment, sample and vital signs.
Right.
You know. So I said to him, what I do with my classes, I have half of them lying on a table, the other half standing behind them facing me. And we do that hands-on head-to-toe examination. And I would do something like, all right, you feel the chest? No, take a look at the chest. Is any part of the chest, which part of the chest comes up first, the left side or the right side? And, of course, the answer is they both come up together. And I said, which one comes up further? And the answer is they both come up the same amount. Which part of the chest sinks in while the rest of the chest is coming out? None of it. None of it. So exactly what you're saying, you need to learn what normal is, those things without pathologies behind them are.
Right.
And we do that first, and that makes much more sense. And I remember my instructors, when we were teaching us assessment, they said, well, this would be a pneumothorax. So I said, well, so what's a pneumothorax? They said, well, we're not going to cover that until we get into trauma. Thanks.
And that's actually kind of interesting, because that teaching process gets somebody to look at, you know, look for the abnormal and not find it. And then they're sort of educating themselves, you know, reinforcing that normal state. So when they do come across the abnormal, because, you know, quite honestly, abnormal readings are far more infrequent than normal readings. I mean, you know, it's the 80-20 rule, really. 80% of our patients.
The definition of normal.
Right. Okay. But, I mean, right. You know, but when we're in the emergency environment and we're there as a responder, we're automatically looking for the abnormal. And many times when you look for something, you find it, you know, even if it's not there.
Yep.
Go zebra hunting.
Well, you know, and we've talked about that on this show before.
Yeah.
You know, it's a real big aspect to sort of settle down and recognize that you haven't found something. And sometimes, you know, like pertinent negatives, it's just as important as your pertinent findings, as your positive findings.
Yep.
Yeah.
I would agree.
So, Jim, you know, I saw the title when I was doing my postings, and I thought it was kind of interesting that you picked this subject to sort of rotate our conversation around today. Have you been in that? I know that you're sort of in that new environment, and you're.
Initially, I started. I thought about this topic. And I initially was going to try to maybe focus and get your guys' feedback and input and maybe listener input, you know, either in the chat or the blog when it's just posted in the archives, you know, their take on influencing management and how to influence people that are within an agency that can make decisions for the agency, whether it's a protocol change, whether it's a medication that you're using or not using, a piece of equipment, things like that. And I started trying to play with the ideas like, you know, how can we, as the line provider, the person who's out in the field, you know, does everybody out there listening know exactly who they should be approaching in their organization that can make, you know, that makes these decisions, that can bring these sort of changes or suggestions up to the proper channels, and not make it sound like it's just somebody bitching because they don't like this monitor. You know, you get people, oh, these monitors suck. There's so much artifact all the time. Oh, you know, I don't like that particular glucometer. I don't like that particular, style of stretcher or whatever the case may be. And instead of making it sound like a bitch about it, that there's a way to intelligently approach the management of an organization and get them to acknowledge that there's an issue or acknowledge that there might be a better way of doing it and sort of go through a process of doing that. And then when I started thinking about that, it's kind of a long-winded way of telling what that whole topic is, but as I started thinking about that, I also started thinking about what influences us as a provider and the decisions we make when we encounter our patients on a day-to-day basis. You know, one example is, you know, you get people who call 911 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, you get there, and it's not really an emergent sort of a call, but for them it's an emergency, and you do your assessment, you do what you have to do for this patient, and now they want to go to a hospital that's far, far away, not because their doctor's there, or because they enjoy, you know, they've had care there before, but because they've heard it's cleaner than the hospital that they used to. You know,
or they didn't have a good experience at their closer hospital.
Yeah, and now this happened on a day-to-day basis. You know, I actually overheard somebody talking about this, how they were trying to sell the person on a closer hospital, you know, because of the fact that they didn't want to drive 45 minutes, an hour, whatnot, to a, further hospital. To the one that the patient wanted to go to, you know. And, you know, to me, the influence that we are influenced by things like that every day, in the job. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Where you'll get people who say, well, you know, it's good for the patient. So as long as the patient does it, that's all that really counts. You know what I mean? As long as you do it right for the patient, you know. But the reality is that a lot of times we're not really doing that. You know, sometimes we do things because it's better for us or it's better for the agency because it's an agency policy somehow. You know what I mean?
You know, there's also there's a flip side to that. And that aspect that what is better for us can sometimes be interpreted to what gives us the fastest, because there are you know, crews out there that are not trying to get out of jobs. They're trying to turn it over so they can get and do another job as rapidly as possible be accessible to the system.
Right.
And in some respects, I'm not going to say in every respect, but in some respects, it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. Go ahead.
I was going to say that, but I think the problem is like in that sort of decision that you make when it comes to a decision of transporting because you need to get back in service, is because sometimes your agency pushes for that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And you're not making the decision necessarily because of it's what the patient really wants or what's best for the patient. In that case, like I mentioned, where it's not really an emergency, and you can pretty much take the patient wherever they want to go because they're stable, they're going to make it to that hospital. You're pushing for a closer facility because it's something the agency would want you to do because they're going to get you a faster turnaround, get you back in service quick.
Yeah, but what I mean, there is an aspect where you have to look at the global, you know, consider the global implications of your decision. Okay, so you have decided to cater to this one patient who is called an ambulance for something that is stable enough that they can transport to their to any facility of their choice, even mm-hmm. one at a distant location. Can you turn that around and say, are they stable enough without any intervention? Meaning, can they take a cab there on their own? You know, do they need your watch? You know, and what are you doing at that time? And I think that there is a certain, I mean, look, there's an aspect that I've heard before. It's called time management. And if you're in a system that is working you to the bone and you just need the mental time to recharge your batteries and you need a break in between a call and you know you're not going to get one as soon as you hit that available button, you know, maybe taking a little longer.
But now,
you know,
Right, but now you see this is another something else that influences our decision. And this is just a small segment of what I'm trying to kind of get across here. But
yeah,
when you think about it, just a couple of things we've just talked about is influencing a decision that we're going to make, whether it's because we don't want to drive that far at 4 o'clock in the morning, or because our agency would rather us get back in service as soon as possible, or, like you said, maybe it's something where you're getting hammered all day on calls, and this could be an opportunity for you to, you know, sort of take a little bit of a break with a little bit of a longer transport and not have a call hanging over your head, you know, as you're still on the one call that you're still doing. You know,
right.
Some people might say, "Oh, that's just people being lazy. People are lazy like that. They're not really good providers. I would hate for them to come to my house and all that bullshit." But to me, everyone I've ever met has taken that sort of an outlook on a call from time to time.
You have to look out for yourself, because first of all, it's your responsibility to look out for yourself. I mean, that is if you look at the Creedon, the initial. The first steps in education and EMS, it's your safety, your partner's safety, and then the patient's safety. Mm-hmm. And you want to loosely translate it from safety to well-being. You know, well-being becomes more of a global idea and a global topic. But, I, when you originally brought this up, I sort of thought it was less about, you know, the decisions that you make on an individual basis or one with your partner, to one where you're trying to convince the powers that be that a certain direction or a certain idea is a good one.
Yeah,
how do you go about doing that?
When I first started with this topic, that was my primary thing, with that. But I think when you're talking about things that influence our decisions in EMS, you can kind of hit on both angles of it. You know, and I do believe it. And like you said, you know, if you've got something that's going on in your agency, whether it's, you know, it could be something time management, like you said, where they're pushing you to get out of hospital within a certain time frame or to be on scene under a certain time frame, things like that. When you bring your point of view to it, or the point of view of the masses of whatever is working, you know, who's working on the street that deal with it on a day-to-day basis, to say that something is not realistic, it's not in the best interest of the patients, it's not in the best interest even of the agency, if you've got people that are rushing and hurrying to get things done, and then documentation is suffering, or even patient care is suffering, because you're getting pushed for a faster turnaround. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, who do you speak to in that regard? Most people say, "Oh, you just go right to the top. You go to the director. You go to, And sometimes they say, "Well, you go to your immediate supervisor and you talk to them about it." But you know, your immediate supervisor's job is to keep shit away from the director, you know, and not bring stuff to the director's attention that doesn't really have any sort of major consequence, you know. So like, what do you do to make this influence? What do you do to sort of get the attention of the people that can make a change, or at least consider it, and give people some sort of an answer as to why they do things the way they do, to make it more, to have it make more sense to the people that are on the street, you know, enforcing these decisions that are made.
I think there's another higher up. I think there's another, a sort of a tangential way of looking at that, because I think that the basic, being non-confrontational, coming up with supporting facts and, targeting the people that you want to deliver the message to is all critical in getting your ideas across. I think there's also the tangential way of looking at your ideas as almost a product, and you are the salesperson trying to pitch it.
Yeah.
And if you sort of step on, look at that, it becomes, because there are two ways the ideas flow, up the chain and down the chain. When an idea flows down the chain, it's generally a boss or command statement, and there's less reasoning for you to do it. You know, you will log in to your system within 10 minutes of your start time. That's not really a suggestion at that point.
Yeah.
You know, it's not an idea. It's, you know, and then, you know, going up the line is, hey, you know, why don't we purchase this new type of stair chair because it'll be easier on the cruise.
Yeah. I love things like that, though, where they say to you, you have to log in within 10 minutes of your start time, yet they want a complete vehicle checklist done and, you know, make sure you have everything and everything's working. And, you know, that's unrealistic to expect someone to check a complete ambulance out in 10 minutes and be in service within that time frame. So they expect people to, what you're telling people to do is to come in early and be on their own time checking out the ambulance so that they can go ahead, you know, and do that. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
You know, you guys aren't talking about anything new here. This is not a new idea. It's not new. It's not new to EMS. It's not new to industry. It's not new anywhere.
You mean
you're talking about
which part of it? The part about getting management to see
every bit of it. Every bit of it. When you study management, now granted, sometimes a mom and pop ambulance company, they didn't study management. They did what they had to do, and they grew into a really big ambulance company. I'm not talking about hospital-based, but even that, good management is good management. Poor management ultimately always works against the business. It'll work against everybody in the business, including the workers. If we were to go back to the reason why unions exist because people were getting hurt. They were working for garbage. They needed to do this. But if you go back, let's say we go back to like 1980. I'm trying to get exactly when I first started hearing about the Japanese quality circles for when you worked in the business. You were part of the business. The business knew you were family. You knew you were dedicated to the business. You had IBM saying, remember their slogan used to be think?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But after that, their slogan was, people support what people create. That's exactly what Josh was talking about before, that there's the top-down dictator style, and then there's the idea that, you know, what would be the best way for us to do this? Well, you know, if it comes from the medics, this is the best way to do it. You know what's going to happen? Once they've had an opportunity to say, this is what we think, this is the way we can do it, and the management says, you know what? I don't know if that's right. I don't know if it's wrong, but you guys are the experts at this. Let's do it your way. It's almost doomed to success. For who? It's doomed to the success of the medics because it's a way that they came to think about it. It's doomed to the success of the manager because this was something the manager wanted done. And if you got people doing it and doing it the right way and doing it because they want to, you know, It's so much a better work environment. Now, do I hear of most ambulance companies employing such great ideas as, you know,
CS1? Well, they're not really, they don't really have advanced management techniques.
Well, you know what Sears Roebuck used to do? Sears Roebuck was a profit sharing organization.
Mm-hmm.
They felt that if everybody was getting paid with a little bit of stock in the company, so that everybody was getting stock in the company, that they would want the company to do well and that they would be invested in it. And back in the 70s, it was an idea that was working well for them. I don't know what they're doing now. But I did study management, administration, supervision, management, whatever you want to call it. And those ideas were ideas that worked. It worked then. It works now in places that are doing it. When you look at some of the things that went on with some of the Googles and the Yahoos, and Adobe, these were environments where people were encouraged to work together. They shared in the profits, and stuff blossomed. And then some places things became oppressive later on. They were bought out and became dictatorial, just like everybody else.
Well, there's always this, you know, look, one of the truisms with business is that, you know, sales and success aren't in a single direction. There are things that go up and down. And very frequently, because our you know, certainly the U.S. or the Western business model is built off of one of showing results, you know, every 15 minutes. And even if that's an exaggeration, there are many people who say showing results over the quarter is not productive to the company in the long run. Whereas if you look at some of the Eastern plans, like the Japanese, you know, 5, 10, 20-year plans, they have 50-year plans
right.
for the companies. And that shows, that allows for mistakes, that allows for errors, that allows for, you know, a longer development cycle instead of, hey, you got to produce. Because a lot of times what you're doing when you're in that cycle is you're scrambling and you're, you know, okay, this isn't doing something right away. Let's try the other wrong thing to do.
Right.
So, you know, you find yourself, you know, but that's, you know, now we're talking about advanced management techniques, advanced management schools that have sort of looked at the big picture, looked at the data over, you know, 5, 10, 20 years, a century, and said, you know, these are the things that seem to have worked out over the long run. You're asking for some very insightful governance. And I'm not sure that we as a breed in EMS really have that as – I think that's more unusual in our foundation,
well,
you know,
Josh,
on any level.
Josh, being a good ambulance, being a good emergency medical care provider –
Ooh, were you about to say ambulance driver?
Not at all.
Yeah, he got close.
I thought he got close.
It wasn't going to be driver. But being an EMS provider – being good at that doesn't make one a good supervisor.
Correct.
Being a person who has a background in medicine and the money to open an ambulance company doesn't make you a good manager. It just makes you the guy in charge because you own it. You know? So people do – you ever watch bars, how many bars open and close? Somebody says, I know how to drink. I'm going to open a bar.
Yeah.
And they open a bar and it opens and closes. How many bars have you seen in the same place?
Oh, food.
Change
have
name?
Restaurants.
Exactly. Yeah, I know how to cook.
I
know how to eat.
Go cook.
What else is there?
Right, exactly. I can open a restaurant. Exactly.
You know, when I worked downtown on Wall Street, you know, we used to have a saying, what's the quickest way to make $1 million?
Start with $10 million.
You start with $2 million and open a restaurant.
That was good. That's
but
good.
But yeah, I mean it's but now you're talking about a situation where there's a lot of variables that affect it. That becomes a high risk business model. Whereas, and that's why the chains are taking over, because in some ways they perfected a little niche market within their business model, and you know we can sell that on every single corner. You know, people want caffeine, people want coffee, and they're willing to walk two blocks for it, but not three, and that's why you see Starbucks every four blocks.
Yeah.
You know, there are things.
That's far apart from Boston.
Yeah, right. But, you know, when we're talking about, and I don't really want to get into, you know, bashing management. I think that there are aspects we've done that and certain aspects that we've defended management, and you know, there are all sorts of things that affect good management and bad management. There's always the Peter principle, which is sort of what you were alluding to before, Dave. You know, the person rises to the highest level of their incompetence. I think that we're talking about working within the systems that we're in and trying to get, you know, what happens when you have a good idea or you've learned something and you want to move that idea forward. You want to get that. And I think there are certain things that you need to do. And looking at it from a sales model isn't the worst way to look at it.
Well, I mean, listen, I've worked for agencies where they were receptive to suggestions for change. They wanted you to present it, make your argument. You know, they wanted you to do it in a professional manner, not just stomp into the supervisor office and say, you know, this sucks. We can't use these type of catheters anymore. Or, you know, this is ridiculous. The batteries are always dying on this type of thing. And But they wanted you to come in and say, you know, this is what I want to change, and here's my, this is why, and they write it, you know, you're supposed to write it up in a nice, you know, understandable, concise sort of a format, and, you know, it was considered, you know. And there were some times when things might have been, were changed, or they would play around with, you know, changing something. I mean, there was one place I worked where I suggested, you know, changing a uniform because, you know, it was so hot during the summer, and I suggested changing the uniform to the polo shirts and whatnot. And the answer was, well, bring me some suggestions of the type of shirts that you think we could use, so we can check out the material. We can look at the material. We can look at the provider. We can look and see how much it costs to get these embroidered or screen, screen printed or whatever. And you know, so it wasn't shot down. No, this uniform we have, and you know, take it or leave it. But at the same time, I also knew places that I've worked that had this sort of policy of, you know, we will.
If
you know,
it comes from you, we don't want to hear it.
No, not that. But what it was I knew there were some things that no matter what I did, no matter how good my idea was or how much feedback that you would hear from other people working with other people, that no matter what you did, there were some things that were going on that wouldn't change because it was like the manager's baby. It was their personal sort of pet peeve, their personal way of doing things. Even though they weren't on the street anymore, like one thing was a drug bag, you know, carrying this gigantic, ridiculous, you know, 2-ton, you know, drug bag around where, you know, there were other options out there where you can make it lighter, make it more efficient. And when I mentioned that, it was like, well, we've tried the smaller ones, but so-and-so doesn't like that. They don't like that way. So we're never going to get away from this way of carrying our stuff. And it's almost like you had to wait until there was a regime change in order
and
to try to make
how
that
you say regime make, change.
Yeah, you know,
because that's how it's looked upon.
You know, until you could bring it up again and say, hey, listen, so and so liked these drug bags or boxes or whatever, and I understand it works, and we've been using it for years. But you know, one thing that I thought would be great to try was this, and so and so never really wanted to try it. What do you think? Maybe we can try it or whatever. And you know what I mean? But until that happened, you couldn't bring up a change like that. You know,
and I think that, you know, if hopefully we have some people who are in management that listen to this show, you know, that is an aspect that's very important, because you won't, if you're, you know, one of the hardest things when I was in management was to elicit good ideas. Well, it wasn't actually in my environment, it wasn't the hardest thing, because that's the culture that we worked in. You know, everybody, we wanted good ideas. Everybody from the lowest assembly line worker to the highest mahogany office, you know, was familiar with the tasks at hand that they had to do, and had certainly had ideas on how to make those, you know, make some part of the process better. And you know, if you have a culture where ideas are accepted, you tend to get better ideas because you have people who are involved in the day-to-day minutiae of a task and can mm-hmm. certainly suggest a better way to do that task. And I think that okay, go ahead.
I was going to say, I completely agree with you, Josh, and I think that your example of the bag is like the perfect example. Because that's a plague everywhere. I know that the people doing first response in my agency hate the bag that they have to carry and the EKG that they have to bring in with the oxygen. I mean, we have this first response car that, boy, oh, boy, if you have anything wrong with your back to start out with, you're going to be suffering.
It's gotten a little bit crazy, and it's a little frustrating because it's like nobody listens. Every time somebody comes out with a new gadget, it's like a must-have that you have to have on the ambulance, but there's no sorting. There's no sort of finesse that goes on, and all of a sudden, you're carrying 110 pounds worth of equipment. You know,
right.
And when I started out as a medic, it was 80 pounds of equipment, and that's still ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, still, listen, to me, I've actually never worked any place where everybody was happy with the equipment being that we had to carry, that the bag was too big or the bag was too small or we're taking too many drugs. And one person I work with, he refused to take the bag in. He would actually keep his own little case of first-line cardiac drugs, like, in a fanny pack because he didn't want to have to carry in the freaking bag on every call. And he figured, well, if we get in there, the guy's dead. I got the first-line drugs, and we can run outside and get the bag if we need it type thing. He was so resistant against carrying it in. And you think about things like even nowadays, Josh, where now, you know, a lot of places you're carrying in CPAP, you're carrying in King Airways now. You know, you're carrying IO needles, you know, IO guns, IO drills into calls. That alone is now is pretty standard on a lot of, you know, agencies, you know, equipment nowadays. And you're expected to bring this in on every call on top of the stuff that you've been bringing in for the past 10 years, and none of that shit's come out of the bag.
Yeah, that's sort of what I was saying.
Well, they took out the Ipecac.
Yeah, great. Yeah, right. You know, if you and that's an excellent, you know, and what suffers in that? You know, I find, you know, we used to take a full liter bag in with us because, you know, you have a hypotensive patient. It's certainly more convenient to have it all in one bag. It's better for the entire process of treatment and everything else. And now you carry in the requirements in like a half liter bag, maybe certainly a couple of 250s. And, you know, you sort of make it work. If you need a full liter, you know, you can put all the bags together.
Sometimes you wonder, like, the shit you bring into the house, when you talk about that type of stuff, like, are we camping out in the house? Are we in there? Especially when we go back to what we talked about earlier about time management and scene time, where they only want you to be on scene for 20 minutes. How much food am I giving in the 20 minutes, or what am I doing in that 20-minute time frame that I'm bringing in pretty much the entire ambulance into the call? You know, I worked at a place, we had three 250 bags and a 1,000 bag and two 100 bags in the fluid.
And that's just fluid.
Yeah, in the box you brought in on top of all your drugs. Now, I'll tell you, the place I work at now, they have the medication that they carry, to me, is a godsend. I mean, we carry the bare minimum of medications, you know, that we're going to use to help people in an emergency, you know, cardiac meds and things like that. Compared to what I was used to carrying drugs that I learned about in school and I've never used once in 20 years being a medic, but they've been on the friggin' in every bag I've ever had.
And, you know, as long as we're on this bitch, I'll just add to it.
Sure.
The stretchers haven't gotten lighter. They've gotten heavier.
Well, even
that power stretcher, which at first I was thinking, this is a great godsend. And I'll be honest, in transport, a power stretcher is a great thing. But holy crap.
Not bringing one.
Yeah, but just lifting a power
stretcher, like
a different material that they use.
Yeah,
they're like steel or something.
I think it's like another, and I think it's like they weigh like another 60, 70 pounds.
100 pounds, I think. I was just
speaking to somebody about that when he was
talking
about
that. It's harder
to
push him down a hall, for crying out loud. It's like, holy crap.
It helps you in the back of the ambulance when you're lifting the wheels up, but other than that, you got to hump this thing up and down, up and down a hallway without a patient on it.
Or okay, you're not in a situation where you can even deal with the stretcher. You're not lucky enough to be able to take your stretcher. You have a stair chair. Now they have these new stair chairs, and they're 40 pounds.
Yeah.
Or 32 pounds, I think.
And sometimes, I understand the new stair chairs that have the treads on them and stuff, that have the tracks. And
they're awesome.
It's great when you're going down the stairs.
They're awesome.
Other than that, they're useless.
Wait a second, Dave. How many five-floor carry-ups have you done with those? How many five-floor?
They're not going up. They're going down.
But go ahead. Yeah, I mean, you can certainly go up. I mean, they're better going up with a patient on them. You know, they have that thought out.
Better going down.
and they're good going up. It's like they're better than the old style stair chair. If you've ever had to carry,
there's a new one that actually goes up steps.
Right.
Well, climbs the steps.
Yes. With the tread, but what I'm saying is somehow those chairs have to get, and we're not carrying multiple chairs for a different task.
You carry
one chair. So now you've just added 17 pounds to the equipment that you have to carry up.
And if you're
a medic, you're carrying that. You're carrying an O2 tank. You're carrying a drug bag, and you're carrying a monitor, and you're carrying suction, and you're carrying CPAP, and the list goes on.
And the thing is, at some places you've got help. You've got first responders to help you carry stuff, and you have a second crew that gets dispatched, and they're helping you carry stuff, or volunteer first responders or whatnot.
But for the most time, it's just you and your partner.
A lot of times you don't have that, especially late at night, especially if you're in a very rural type of an area. You don't necessarily get that assistance. But the patient you're encountering that has the chest pain, that's having the STEMI, is the same patient you're going to see in the city that you're going to see out in the country someplace. And they deserve the same, you know, equipment and the same skills and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's when it ends up, it might just be you and your partner trying to bring all that stuff in and out of the house.
I think that's what happens, is that we've lost that connection between the field and the laboratory where this stuff is developed.
And then you talk about influencing decisions, Josh. I mean, when you get that call, and it's a sick call, and the policy of the company says you bring in everything, but in your mind you're like, well, the computer says the guy's been sick for a week, he's got a fever, do I really have to bring in the monitor? Do I really have to bring in the CPAP and all that?
Maybe I'll just, and you find some people cutting corners.
I'll just bring in the oxygen on this one.
Right.
So there you go again, things that influence our decisions based on experience, based on being overworked, you know, sometimes based on somebody who just has a bit of a lazy streak that day.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know when you do that, when you leave something back on the ambulance, you know you're going to need it.
That's when you need it.
You know there's going to be witnesses.
Yeah.
And you know you're in trouble.
Right. Yeah, that's when you get into the house and, you know.
It's a code.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the question is, how do we influence the decision process to improve our work environment? And I think that's the question everybody who's tuning in is listening for. And I think, unfortunately, the short answer is there's no sure way because of the differences in the level of management that we face in our different
teams. And unfortunately, I think some places where, you know, your pitch, like you said, Josh, you're almost pitching it like you're just trying to sell something to them, that if you're the one pitching it, it's almost like you're the naysayer, you know, and will there be repercussions because you don't like the way something's being done, you know, and you think you've got the better idea on how to do it, and now manager's looking at you as maybe the potential problem, or, you know, if you complain about, let's say, a certain monitor or like you said, even a stair chair, and then management catches you not bringing the stair chair into the building. Now they've got something to say, well, you know, you don't like that stair chair. That's why you didn't bring it in. Just show up to it. Say that's why you didn't do it. You know what I mean? So it's almost like, you know, you kind of have to have that environment of management that's willing to listen to suggestions.
Yeah, but even if you don't, I mean, or even if you're not sure, in any case, there are probably some universal factors that will help any argument have its best chance of being accepted. And I think that there are a few things that a person can do to sort of set the stage to have their idea received in the best light possible. Certainly, one of those is the aspect of not being confrontational.
Right.
You know, you don't go in, if you really want this idea, the way to win that, even if what's currently in use is stupid, you know, in your eyes or in everybody's eyes, you never go in and say, hey, the way we're doing this is stupid. This is a better way to do it.
I mean, one way is
non-confrontational.
Yeah, I mean, something that I've always done, and not even just with EMS, but other jobs that I've worked in, when I wanted to make a suggestion for a change, or even somebody that was working with me or under me as an employee or whatever, is I would always try to point out some of the positive things of that first before I delved into the negative things.
You know, ultimately, the owners and the supervisors, ultimately, most of them are in this business either A, to make money, or B, to provide better patient care. And I suspect that money, unfortunately, drives the system, because without money, you can't run the system.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to talk to the money end of this. If you have an idea that's going to be better, it needs to be presented in a way that the people at the top understand that this is going to be better for them.
Yeah.
How are things going to be? I'm going to go back again because I'm old. I get to go back. All right, but I don't have to go that far back. Can you think of a company that works out of where's that place in Colorado? I think it starts with an A. I forgot. Well, anyway, I'll tell you the company. The company is the Coors Company. Where are they? Golden, Colorado. Golden, Colorado. Right,
mm-hmm.
That's where they're from. You guys know that? You heard of them?
Yes.
You heard
of
Coors,
absolutely.
Right?
I've heard of Coors, yeah, of course.
Okay. So this guy
actually had Coors before they shipped it all over the country. The only place you could get it was out west.
Right. I saw that. Smokey the Bandit, right? Smokey and the Bandit.
Was that Smokey? No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think they were smuggling Coors. It doesn't matter. Because I am distractible. Oh, look, a squirrel. what I wanted to point out was somebody goes there to the Coors Company and says, listen, I think that what you guys need is you need to have a gym right in the factory. And I think you need to hire somebody to teach people how to lift. It's good. You got people going out. What's the number one cause people go out of work for in EMS? Same thing as the people that are throwing kegs of beer. Their backs are killing them. They get back injuries. They go out. Sometimes they go out forever on disability. And then companies pay a fortune for this. All you got to do is tell them to look at your workman's comp. So if we went in there and said, listen, you need to build a gym. You know what happened when they built a gym? And interestingly, because the company, Coors, was self-insured. They paid whatever insurance they were providing, medical insurance, prescription insurance. They didn't hire Blue Cross Blue Shield. They paid it out of their pocket, feeling that they were big enough that if Blue Cross Blue Shield could make money on it, we could save money by doing it the way Blue Cross Blue Shield would do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was they built this gym and they encouraged people to go and they brought in people to teach them the dynamics of lifting beer, which, by the way, is not much different than lifting our patients, except you can't just grab it by the handle. And in the first 5 years, they saved $600,000 in workman's comp bills, in the fewer people that were absent. When somebody's absent, somebody else gets overtime.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you present your ideas carefully, for example, the Sega Splint. You guys carry Segas where you are?
Nope.
No.
I don't.
No, because you're carrying hair. I'm surprised you guys don't carry a Spanish windlass. You're carrying hair. You know why you're carrying hair? I mean, that's what you're carrying, right? Hair
right,
traction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Hair, my own personal opinion, and I have no stock in any of this stuff. I am not beholden to any one of them. The hair, I used to love the hair. You know what I loved about the hair? That I knew how to do it and it looked cool. But it was a barbaric device. It was truly barbaric. You needed two people to put it on. And the Sega is easier. One person puts it on. It's calibrated. The hair is not. You remember when they told you pull it till they feel relief?
Yeah.
Like, get the hell out of here. Yeah. So now when you put on a hair traction, you could put away your morphine, because they never need it after that, because they've already gotten relief. The fact of the matter is the Sega is, in my opinion, a far superior device. And the reason why people aren't using it is because nobody in New York City is teaching it. By the way, I've been teaching it since 1989, okay? And once you use them both, you'll never forget your first Sega. You're just like your first Paulie girl. You're never going to forget it. It is so easy. It's so much better. It's calibrated. You can put on 5 pounds, 10 pounds of traction. You know what you're doing. You're not pulling until the leg falls off. We always do what we've always done. I would go and say to the manager, I say, this is a better device. You're going to get sued less often. You need fewer people to put it on. It's lighter. It may be cheaper. It may not be cheaper, but it's certainly not significantly more expensive. I would do it to them. The patients are going to get better care, and it's just a smaller piece of equipment. And so, you know, I would present everything that way.
Yeah, and then what's going to happen is that management's going to go, you know, I have enough things to worry about, enough decisions to make, and how often do we use a traction splint in all our patients? And, of course, in the subject matter of, hey, look, squirrel, we can divert to what do you think where do you think the protocol should be when it comes to open or close femur fracture?
Boy, you
because
are
you
only, holy yeah. mackerel.
Yeah, because, you know, the current protocol, and I've had this argument for a long time, and if you've noticed, the New York City protocol went back and forth. They've now gone back to that and the wording is even more vague, that the traction splint is the splint of choice in all closed mid-shaft fractures.
Right.
Right. What does that mean? Does that mean that you're not supposed to use it for an open?
I don't know what it means for the open. That's your New York City protocol there. I would ask them. I would put it in writing and ask them.
Yeah.
But I don't ride in New York City, so I don't have to do that.
So now where are you in, do you use a traction splint for an open fracture?
Is there significance just
because the bone poked through the skin?
I don't think it's significant. I think what you need to do is stabilize the fracture.
I agree.
That's what we do.
I agree. But, you know, it's kind of interesting that, you know, that this continually comes up on the rare occasions that you have that. And now in my career, I've done it about 4 or 5 times. And I'm consistently, you know, annoyed at the nonsense that comes out of the discussion afterwards. Oh, you can't use, you know, if you put it out there on in social media, you know, the answer you get is you can't use it on open fractures because pulling the bone back in will contaminate the wound.
Yeah. You've got to live to contaminate the wound.
I am now, we're giving antibiotics for open fractures.
Yeah, so
okay.
I would tell you that the New York State protocol doesn't mention the word open or closed. New York City, of course.
But I've heard the same thing, Josh. So open fractures, you're not supposed to use on open fractures. It's supposed to be closed.
All right, but I'm looking
mid-shaft,
right now.
Mid-shaft, femur only, you know.
Here is the indications. Are a painful, swollen, deformed mid-thigh injury with no joint or lower leg injuries. Done. It doesn't speak to
doesn't tell you one way or the other.
Right.
Until you start asking questions, and then people might give you different answers.
Well, people make up answers whatever they want. But
yeah,
if we deal with that for an agency, I would go to the agency's medical director. You know what? What you need to be doing is talking to orthopedic surgeons. We shouldn't be talking to managers about this. These are medical decisions. They're not management decisions. Those are the wrong people to talk to. Unfortunately, sometimes it's the only person to talk to. But I worked very briefly for a private agency, which I'm not going to tell you who it was. But you know what I found? I found that I had a direct line to the medical director. The medical director came in and did the orientation for myself and some new hires. He gave us his phone number, and he said, if you guys have medical questions, you call me.
And you know,
I thought that was awesome.
And you know, Dave, too, it's important that you said that because, you know, and this goes back to the influencing we're talking about, is when you've got a medical director that is approachable, you can go to them with these types of things. Say, hey, listen, you know, I need clarification on this.
Right.
Because I've asked 10 different people, I got 10 different answers.
So let me pull up.
I really need clarification on this particular thing. And if they don't give it to you right away, you can guarantee they're going to come back and give it to you because they're thinking, you know, this is something that I'm signing off on.
Yep. So let me pull us back from the squirrel, you know, chasing the tree and the shiny objects back to this whole how to influence the decision. So we've already talked about being non-confrontational, all right? You're not going to get anywhere by insulting the people you're trying to sell to.
Exactly.
You have to address the bottom line, which is money, because in the end, the biggest factor in these decisions is driven by cost. Is it the risk end of the cost? Is it the liability? Is it the application? Is it a betterment for patient care? Now we're on to the other part, which is build a case for the idea that you have using non-emotional facts. If
yes.
you can get experts, all the better. So if you can talk
citing resources, citing research,
exactly.
and all that type of stuff, and again, you know, trying to cite how it's going to help them, and even helping them in a financial sort of way, or even helping them in a way to suggest that it could help them with a litigation type thing, anything
Absolutely.
Like that. You know what I mean? That they can look at and say, okay, hey, listen, this is a guy that's not just looking for this because he doesn't want to carry a heavy bag. He's also looking at this because it could be a better way to help patients, which in turn could help us save money or maybe help us from getting sued or having somebody complain about something that happened to them. And then, you know, but like you said, Josh, you have to do it in a way that is factual, that is not confrontational. It's almost like you're gonna do it as if you were writing a grant
right.
to try to get grant money for something.
Right. So you want to build a sort of a factual foundation for your argument. Now, there's another part that a lot of people don't consider because they usually see, you know, especially in the EMS environment, the management structure is much smaller usually. It's not that heavily layered. You may have a supervisor. You may have a manager, et cetera. But, you know, you usually, you know, somewhere along the line, you can go direct to your manager, direct to the department director, or even your medical director. But a lot of times in these cases, and if you think about it, if you use the barroom etiquette of having a debate, what do? You know, you turn to your buddies that are sort of listening in and say, hey, George, don't you agree with this
yeah.
point? So you get supporters. So now you have an idea what you need to do. And I don't mean just supporters in the field, although that's good as well. If you have other paramedics that like your idea, you know, certainly get them on board because there's, you know, more that's merrier with that party. But the other aspect is look at management and try, even if you can't get to the decision maker, try to get to the people who can influence the decision maker and get them on your side. So build a consensus amongst supporters is probably the fourth and equally important aspect of getting your decision listened to.
Yeah, yeah.
Getting your idea listened.
Yeah.
Do you have a bullet list, Josh?
I know. We should put this in a bullet list and put it up on the blog, actually, and give people a little bit of guidance maybe. But I'll say this, though. Just we got to kind of wrap it up, but when you talk about what we talked about, Josh, as far as putting this together and stuff.
Years of school at Hard Knocks, Dave.
Well, the question you have to ask is how many people out there are willing to put that effort in to make those changes and to try to be the one that influences the changes, you know? And unfortunately, I don't think there's that many people that are willing to sit down and formulate this an argument like that and to compile it in a way that is an argument that either can't be broken by management or, you know, an argument that sounds non-confrontational. It's much easier for somebody to stomp around and bitch to their coworkers.
Sure, sure.
And storm into a manager's office and throw some piece of equipment on the desk and say, this is a piece of crap. You know, I can't believe we're using this. You know, every other agency in the county is using this. Why are we still using this, archaic piece of equipment? You know what I mean?
Old saying? If it feels good to say, it's probably the wrong thing.
Yeah, that's my problem.
You So there's another aspect, and I'll leave it. I'll leave this and with the last thought is that be prepared for failure. Be prepared to be rejected. Don't give up, because persistence is the one thing that wins out overall, and that's a fine line. You can't be annoying. You can't go in just because, you know, you may need to give it a rest.
Right.
Certainly, you know, but be prepared to be turned down. You know, a lot of times that just helps you build your argument and address the things that the reasons, you know, so you can come back again.
Yeah. No, you're right.
Those are the things that will allow you to influence a decision. If you're truly interested, if you're sitting there and there's this burning desire to correct something that you feel is wrong, you know, those are the steps that you should be following to, you know, help at least make a strong case. It won't always win, but it'll help you make the strongest case possible.
Yeah. That's a good point. Listen, guy, we'll end it there. Of course, thanks for joining. I think we had a good discussion. You know, again,
I thought that was great.
We're not having the answers here. Hopefully, it'll just maybe open some people's eyes and some maybe not make people as intimidated when they think that they've got a good idea, and maybe give them some ideas on how to approach it with their management and decision-making processes. So if anything, if we get one person out there that might do that, that's fine with me, and I think we've succeeded. You know, if we can at least do that. So, as always, thanks for joining, guys. Go check Josh out over at wantnew.com. Dave, I will get the dates up when you email those to me if you can, or to Josh, and Josh will talk to me about your upcoming class in Detroit. I think it's a great opportunity for people to take advantage of. So I'll be sure to get that up there so people have time to sign up. So that's it. Anything else, guys, you want to talk about before we end off for the night?
No, it sounds good.
All right, everybody, that's it for us. Again, any comments, questions, send them over to me. My email is contact@emsofficehours.com. Until next week, as always, Jim Hoffman, stay safe.